What comes to mind when you hear the term ethical storytelling?
Well, I think I've been that idea has been in the conversation, at least in my world, for a while. And I think one of the things that was really clear to me a number of years ago is that there has to be a little bit of a generosity built into the conversation, because we're all on a learning curve. There are things that I did in my work as a photographer and as a filmmaker 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 1 year ago, that I wouldn't do today. And I think it can be really easy to look at other people that are telling stories of all kinds, and easily cast judgment or project our own sort of values onto them. And I think, you know, I think as with a lot of things in this day and age where we are very polarized, I just think there has to be a bit of built-in generosity so that we can engage and talk about these issues. But for me, like, it always comes back to the same thing when it comes to storytelling, especially when it comes to telling a true story, is to, as much as I can, use my ability as a storyteller to actually create a microphone for other people to tell their own story. So, you know, with documentary films.
Is that your phone by chance?
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. Let me turn it.
Yeah. If you'll just silence anything or turn off messages.
It's not my phone. It's my iMessage on my computer.
So yeah. If you don't mind, I don't know if there's a way to silence that, but maybe just turn it off for now.
Let me see if I can. And I quit it. Yeah, my phone's not near me, and it's on silent.
Yeah, I think if you sign out of it, it won't pop open then.
Okay, let's see if that works. anyway, as I was saying, or how far back should I go?
I think just the last comment about giving voice.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was, one of the first lessons I got, I guess that I had in this was, 7 or 8 years ago, I was in Uganda working on Shake the Dust, my first documentary. And I met this guy, Oscar, who at the time was, I think, 17 years old. And, you know, he was not going to be a part of the documentary film, but I asked him if he would help me with the camera. And I think, you know, just including him in the process of telling his friends' stories was really meaningful. It helped me learn a lot. It helped me get access that I wouldn't have had before. And it helped me, I think it helped the people that we were documenting be more authentic. But more importantly, Oscar then learned a skill. He learned how to carry a camera, carry a microphone, and now he's making documentary films. So I think, you know, a big theme of my adult life has been not to try and tell other people's stories, but to help them tell their own story. And so that to me is what ethical storytelling is. It's not taking someone's story away and repurposing it, but letting it, letting them own it and letting them ultimately be the ones that tell it.
I love that. Yeah, I think we are full on board with that perspective. And you and I met through the nonprofit world. So for everyone listening, can you tell me a little bit more about how did you enter into filmmaking in the nonprofit sector?
Well, I graduated 10 years ago with a degree in photography and had kind of already developed the travel itch, both as a part of and separately from that. And so right out of college, I worked on a documentary film team in Thailand that Rachel knows well. And that was my first foray into storytelling and into and into not only the nonprofit world, but the world of, I guess, of documenting suffering in a way. And I learned a lot of lessons on that trip. As I said, I started out as a photographer, but as the years went on, that was one trip. And then because I went on that trip, I was invited by another organization to go on a, you know, a trip to Africa, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was kind of the go-to guy to take along on, you know, for nonprofits to take along to document the work that they were doing. And as the years went on, very quickly I transitioned from photography into filmmaking, especially with the change in technology that happened, and continued to do short form video pieces for nonprofit organizations and for companies that had some kind of a social enterprise component of what they were doing. But I also started using the jobs that I was taking to fund my first documentary, Shake the Dust. And sometimes I'd piggyback on trips and go film here and there for that as well.
Yeah, you mentioned that with technology changing and probably access to cameras, a lot of that has really developed over this past 10 years. And even the idea of making films for nonprofits is a fairly new landscape, a new idea. So, you know, how have you seen any set standards as, you know, we have in journalism, you have journalism practices and do's and don'ts. When you entered that space, was there really any standard for nonprofit storytelling? Were we held to the same standards as journalism or other forms of filmmaking?
Unfortunately, no, I don't think so. I haven't seen that too. And I think it's sad. And I think, you know, at the core of this is another issue, which is not the nonprofit world. And that's, you know, there are nonprofits that are doing really good work. There are nonprofits that are not, and there is everything in between. And I think that's a whole other, you know, that's not disconnected from this idea of storytelling, is you might be telling the story really, really well and really ethically, but the organization might be misguided in its efforts. And so that's something that has been a challenge for me too, is trying to find the right partnerships with the right companies and organizations, and they're not all perfect. I don't think any of them are perfect. But that has been a challenge as well, because I don't think that there's not a lot of set standards out there for nonprofits either. There's all kinds of conversations about what is right and what is helpful and what is not. But that filters into the storytelling components as well. And I think there are friends of mine even that I see being very vocal about this idea of ethical storytelling and then still doing things on their Instagram accounts or on their blogs or social media that to me are a little questionable. And I probably do that too. I think when we go into a place, especially a place that has experienced hardship and suffering or is underserved in some way, it can be very easy to accidentally exploit the people that we're very much trying to help. And it goes the same for nonprofit work, for, you know, trying to contribute or help the problem. Oftentimes we bring new problems, into this situation or exacerbate problems that are there. And I think the only way that we can solve that, is to have these kinds of conversations. And, you know, as far as a list of principles, you know, ideally a good journalist has a very set standard of do's and don'ts. And I think, you know, those create guidelines. A journalist still has to use their moral compass in almost every story that they tell, but I think it at least creates a system of guidelines and understandings of what is for sure okay and where the lines need to be drawn. And it's amazing to me that we don't have that in telling stories for brands and for nonprofits and in the campaigns that we do and the photos we take. And it's no wonder that I see more and more of a backlash. You know, a couple of years ago, I was in Ethiopia shooting for Oliberté, which is a boot company out of Canada that just make quality boots out of Ethiopia, and pay fair wages. They're the first fair trade shoe company in existence. And I was out just getting B-roll of Addis, and I was just out filming in the streets, but I was in an area of Addis that's not the greatest. And I don't even know that I recognized that or knew, you know, that I was filming in a poor neighborhood. But a young man, probably 17 years old, came up to me and said, "Please stop filming this." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "We don't need more people to film this neighborhood. There's lots of other things in Otis for you to film." I just thought that was, you know, and I stopped, and I just thought that was interesting. You know, I don't think that would have happened 5 years ago, even, where you would go into, you know, especially in East Africa, if you pulled a camera out, everyone would gather around, or, you know, or they would maybe be uncomfortable, but they wouldn't certainly try and stop you. But I think more and more I'm seeing people say, "Stop filming me. You haven't, I haven't given you permission to film me."
Yeah,
that got a little tangential, but
no, that's fantastic. Thanks, Adam. There was one point you said that I would love to kind of go back to and ask you to expand on a little bit more, which is talking about, you know, the nonprofit world doesn't necessarily have those standards right now. And it sounds like you really had to create your own set of standards for what you're looking for in nonprofits. And so can you share a bit about what that discernment process is like for you as you're deciding whether or not to partner or come on board with a nonprofit to help them produce their story?
Yeah, that's a really good and tough question. And it's, you know, I think it's always evolving for me. I, you know, whenever a nonprofit or a company wants me to work with them, I have a pretty frank conversation with them. I'll try and think of a few of the things that I would ask, but you know, it really can depend on it. It's pretty specific to whoever they are as a company or an organization. But a lot of it comes down to how are you, you know, working with the locals to empower them? What is the long-term goal? You know, what are you eventually trying to pass this along so that the local people can take ownership of it? And you know, are you treating this like a company where you don't ever want to have to close your doors? You know, ideally you go in to try and solve a problem and help the people solve a problem, come alongside people that are poorly resourced to try and solve their own problems. And so usually my lines of questioning will be along that, you know. For a larger organization like Project Red, Bono's organization, which receives a lot of criticism internationally for a variety of reasons, but you know, they essentially all of the money that they raise goes directly back to the Global Fund, and the Global Fund, which is an international fund that is governed out of Switzerland but is contributed to by nearly every country in the world, has you know, a governing body that has a kind of a stringent set of principles on what governments it will work with, what governments are too corrupt to be able to actually monitor where the resources go. And I've been on the ground and seen the, you know, dollars go directly back alongside government efforts that are already happening against HIV in East Africa. So that's an example where I've seen the waterfall from someone buying, you know, someone relatively disconnected from the HIV issue in Africa, buying, you know, an iPhone or, you know, buying a Starbucks or something that is a Product Red product, and that money going directly back to work alongside locals. So even though there is a part of me that, you know, is sad by, you know, is saddened by campaigns like this where, you know, where it's just driven by consumerism, a consumer goes and buys a product and, you know, someone else is maybe helped a little bit by, and then the consumer gets to feel good. That's a situation where I was like, okay, I can work with this organization because they, even though the consumer may be disconnected a little bit, or maybe they feel good and that's okay, I know the money is going directly, as best as it possibly can, it's going directly to help end HIV in Africa down to a clinic level. I mean, and so it varies for every organization, and it's imperfect, and I'm sure my filter is imperfect, and there are other people that, for example, wouldn't work with Product Red. But I use that as an example almost because it is a more contentious, brand. to kind of help understand what my filter was for that.
On the reverse, are there certain filters you suggest nonprofits should have with photographers or storytellers?
That nonprofits should have with their storytellers?
Yes, in selecting, you know, who to take on assignment with them.
Oh, yes. You know, it's interesting because a lot of times when you're traveling, you know, lately I'm more often the filmmaker or the guy with the video camera and not the stills photographer. And so it's interesting because sometimes you get partnered with other people and you get to see how they work. And I've been fortunate that most of the time I've worked, you know, really well with other people. There's a guy named Johns out of South Africa that I've worked with, and we have the same mentality. Esther Havens, I've worked with her where I was shooting a video and she was shooting stills. I think, but then I've also observed the opposite, and it's a lot of the time it's inexperience that I think these things, the more time that you spend in traveling the world and going into someone else's home and into someone else's community, I think the more sensitive and self-aware you become. But I think as far as actual standards, man, ask someone before you want to film them. I mean, yeah, I just feel like so often, especially videographers, they just wander in and just start filming people. And that's not okay in any culture. You know, that would not be okay here. And I think there has to be a sense of you know, restoring these people's dignity. And so much of, especially in a place that's war torn or that is tremendously under resourced, their dignity is already in jeopardy in so many regards. And, but they still have dignity and they still have their humanity. And I think we take something from them when we just wander in and begin documenting their lives without their permission or without getting to know them. I mean, you know, when I'm maybe a better example is when I'm working on a documentary film, I never just pull my camera out when I have a subject. I spend a decent amount of time with them first, sometimes days, sometimes I do a trip where I just hang out with them and I don't even start filming yet. I mean, I feel like it's important to develop a relationship, and sometimes you can't go that far. If you're just, you're in the field for a few days to try and document the work of a nonprofit, then maybe you only have an hour with someone, but you go in, you usually, if you're going into someone's home, they're going to offer you refreshments or something. You sit down, you ask them questions, you ask them about their kids, you get to know them, and then you say, is it okay if we tell your story, and you explain who you are, and you have to create a setting in which they don't feel coerced or pressured to do it either. I mean, I just think, any little old lady that I'm going to interview, I'm going to treat like my grandma, you know, I'm going to treat with, sorry, my iMessage is still blowing up and I don't know how to get it to stop.
Adam, if you go to your preferences in iMessage.
Okay.
Click on messages and then go to preferences. And then click on accounts.
Okay.
And then click on your account and then click on log out.
Okay. Sign out. Yeah. Okay. Okay. There we are.
Problem solved. Yeah, I think that was a lesson I learned too in spending time with people before cameras, where I almost make that standard myself when nonprofits hire me, is I have to have a day of pre-production, which literally only includes me spending time with the story subjects, like a full day before, and just working it in, because you can have limited time, but you can also make it part of the production schedule. You know, it has to be just as important as filming.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and I think one of the, you know, that makes reminds me, you know, a lot of times a nonprofit has control over the schedule, and I think it's really important for the filmmaker or the photographer to consult with the nonprofit on the schedule beforehand, because I think a lot of times the nonprofit organizations I work with are really motivated to get as much possible filming in. I see this again and again. It's like, try and film as much as possible. Like get as many, you know, if we're trying to visit, do home visits, try and get as many home visits in as possible. If it's clinics, get as many clinics in as possible. And I'm always fighting against that because it's like, first of all, not building in any time for human connection here. And that has to happen. It has to happen not just on an ethical level. It has to happen for your photos to be good. But also a lot of times getting the story right means spending time with one person. You're not going to be able to necessarily do a super effective 2-minute, 1-minute piece about the work you're doing, let's say fighting malaria, if you just spent, you know, 10 minutes in a clinic and then went to the next place and then went and filmed a whole bunch of B-roll and then visited two people's homes and then left. Like, sometimes it is sitting with a story and letting that story play itself out, letting you know, people open up and feel comfortable. That's not just ethical storytelling. That's good journalism. That's good storytelling in general. It's, you know, patience. And so I'm always pushing back against nonprofits to say, look, like, you got to cut some of these out, or we got to go for an extra 2 days so that we actually have time to properly do this. And otherwise it's a waste of time and it's a waste of money. It's a waste of your donors' money that you're spending on plane tickets and paying me, you know.
Well, I'd love to talk about your film, I Am Sun Mu, and you just released that on Netflix last year, is that correct?
It came out in February, February 1st.
Oh, great. So can you give us a brief background on that film? And I'm also particularly interested in your collaboration with Link in the process of that.
Yeah, so we worked on this film. It's a feature documentary about a North Korean dissident artist who actually worked for the North Korean regime. You know, everybody in North Korea serves in the military, and his job in the military was to be a propaganda artist. And so when he escaped to the South, he went to one of the best fine art schools in Seoul in South Korea, and has gone on to become a pretty well-established pop artist in South Korea and in Asia, and he's popular in Europe as well. He doesn't show his face and operates under the name Sun Mu, which is not his real name, just to protect his family back in North Korea. But as a defector from North Korea, he was introduced to Liberty in North Korea, which is an organization that works with refugees. They not only do they have an underground railroad that actually helps North Koreans escape to safety and make it into South Korea or the United States, where they have clearer paths to citizenship, but also they help with repatriation, they help with counseling, with, you know, language issues, and they help refugees transition, and it can be a very, very challenging transition when you're coming from North Korea. So I they're doing amazing work, and I was connected with them years ago. In 2009, I started shooting with them and helping them document their work. I worked on a short film with them about a North Korean young guy named Danny back in 2012. And when I was filming that in Seoul, Justin Wheeler, who's the then vice president of Liberty in North Korea, said, "Hey, there's this awesome artist named Sun Mu. Do you want to go meet him?" So we went to his studio, and I walked into his studio, and I was blown away by his work. Just really interesting stuff. Some of it's hilarious, a lot of it's satirical, but a lot of it's really heartbreaking. Some of it's really hopeful. He has two daughters, and he often incorporates them into his paintings, depicting young North Korean school children walking with young South Korean school children, which is a really dynamic image on the peninsula. So I fell in love with his heart. We went out drinking that night in Seoul, which if anyone knows, the culture in South Korea is, you know, you kind of have to keep up with whoever is hosting you. And so I had a wild night, and he had been very resistant to having anyone tell his story, but he mostly, I think, through his trust in Liberty in North Korea and their confidence. Again, not filming him, but just hanging out, he eventually agreed to let me do a documentary about him. And it was about a year and a half later that he was given the opportunity to have a huge solo exhibition in China. And that felt, I knew we didn't have the resources to do like an 8-year documentary about him, you know, to spend the better part of a decade just documenting him and figuring out what the story was later. I knew we needed kind of a peg to hang the story on. And so that show in Beijing felt like the perfect opportunity to have a, you know, kind of a center point. And so I began flying out to South Korea and to Beijing to document his preparations for that show, which ended up being a pretty climactic event.
Yeah, and a huge part of that was just his identity, having to protect his identity, and even his family, I know, joined him there. And one thing I found really interesting is so much of the film, which is beautifully shot without revealing his face, I found it really interesting that you did show his wife and children's faces. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about how you came to that decision with the film so centered on not revealing his identity.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. And it's the number one question that I got during the film festival circuit. And it's a valid one, but it has a good answer. First of all, there's a couple layers to it. First of all, Sun Mu's main concern is for his family back in North Korea, and his family in South Korea are South Koreans. They never have lived in North Korea, and they have no connection to North Korea beyond the war 50 years ago. So that's point number one. Now, that being said, everyone would follow up with, well, it seems like it would be pretty easy if you could figure out his family's identity to track him down and figure out who he is and what he looks like. And that's absolutely true. I think the reality is Sun Mu every single day decides what freedoms to give up and what freedoms to have. And almost every defector chooses to not show their face if they have any family back home, even if it's not practical. We have no idea if the North Koreans know who Sun Mu is or if they've had the ability to connect him back to his actual family. We know as of right now, his family in North Korea is still safe. But Sun Mu made the decision about whether or not to show his kids' faces and his wife's face, not only in our film, but in his own paintings. I mean, he paints pictures of his daughters and his wife. And, you know, I followed his lead every step of the way. You know, I said, Sun Mu, you know, it's up to you whether you want to show your face, whether your wife and your kids want to show their faces. And I think part of it is Sun Mu's always running up against that idea what freedoms to keep and what freedoms to give up. And he, you know, he came to our premiere, for example, the premiere of the film, the world premiere of the film was at the demilitarized zone on the border of North Korea, on the South Korean side, obviously. And he and his wife came with their kids and had this notion that they would just, that Sun Mu wouldn't hang out with them and they would be kind of separate and he would kind of blend in with the crowd. And I thought it was insane. But it was his choice. And at the, you know, after the film was over, I walked up to them and it was held at this military base. And they were able to remain relatively anonymous. We didn't bring them up or anything or point them out, but you know, his wife and his daughters left pretty quickly because they felt they kind of realized that they were putting themselves at risk or danger of exposing Sun Mu. And so that's a really long answer to say that I don't think Sun Mu knows what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And there's nobody there to tell him what's okay and what's not okay. But for most North Koreans, it's impossible for them to even think about showing their face in public, in print, on screen, because of their background and because of their kind of subconscious fear of the regime. And so he does maintain that tradition. And even now when he shows up at gallery openings or travels, he wears a mask when he's up in front of an audience or when he's being pointed out. When he can't kind of just be anonymous, he wears a mask, but then oftentimes he'll just take the mask off right afterwards and walk away, and theoretically people could photograph him. So I think he's always walking a fine line. I think part of it is a lot of people want to compare him to Banksy, where Banksy, you know, very strategically guards his identity, and it's not quite that extreme, even though you could argue that Sunmu has way more reason to be that extreme.
Definitely. I think that, you know, you spoke about he was the one deciding when to show his face or his family's face. And could you speak into a little more of what role does the person you're filming play in deciding how far to go with their stories, especially when you're approaching dangerous topics such as those in North Korea? You know, what role does the person have to play when they don't have someone guiding them, telling them, you know, how far to go? And what role do you need to play in helping also protect a person's story?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's one of the hard things as a filmmaker, because as a documentary filmmaker, you're meant to be curious. You're supposed to be willing to go to the dangerous places and to put yourself in danger. And, you know, I think a lot of the times a documentary filmmaker in particular is going somewhere and putting themselves more at risk than their subject. Their subject is already probably at risk or is living somewhere where they're at risk. And, you know, but this was a situation where I'm an American citizen. There's not a whole lot that in China or in Korea that anyone can do to me. But really, it's Sunmu that's at risk. And so I just had to be constantly communicating with him. Is this okay? Are you comfortable with this? And pointing out to him regularly, are you sure you want to do that? You know, Sunmu, for his opening in China, was going to come to the opening. And he had all these different ideas. He was going to wear a costume, this or that. And as the opening approached, you know, we all had a conversation about it. And we all contributed our point of view of whether it was safe or not. And it ended up being, you know, it didn't even end up, once you see the film, you understand why, it didn't even end up being an issue, because he was fleeing before he could even think about coming to the opening. But I think it's communicating. And as much as I'm always wanting to put, you know, as the filmmaker wanting to, you know, document something that's exciting or adventurous or, you know, be fearless. And I have a little bit of that like recklessness in me. I also have to recognize that this is someone else's life at all times. I can't ever lose sight of that. And I have to advise them as I would advise anyone when I feel like we're in a dangerous situation. Obviously, when you have a camera on you, you stand out. And so, yeah, I think it's about that conversation. It helps when you are their friend. You know, there are documentary filmmakers. I don't think this is the same when you're working with a nonprofit and you're trying to tell someone's story. I think it's quite fine to be come close with your subject. There are some documentary filmmakers that do not want to be close with their subject. They want to remain a fly on the wall and not insert themselves. I don't follow that. I don't think that's logical. I don't think that exists. You know, I think if you're actually documenting someone for a long enough time, like, you are in the story now. Like, you can't avoid it. You are a part of it. You now know things, and there's just no way to not be a part of it. And so in my mind, like, with Sunmu, we were friends. I mean, we had spent way more time off camera than we had on camera. We had had endless meals together and had such a rapport, even without speaking each other's language, that it just becomes a lot easier to make those moral choices and to try and to protect his safety, because he is now my friend and we're in this together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely does. Have you ever seen a person in a film put in a dangerous circumstance because of their story being told?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of some good examples. I saw something recently where that happened. Let me think for a second.
Take your time. Or even in any nonprofits you've worked with where they might have realized it after the fact of a film being released or photograph being released.
Well, I have to admit that I've worried about that with I Am Sun Mu, not even as much with Sun Mu, but, it's interesting. This was a decision that I made, and I know I'm not the only person who's done this, but it's not the preference of a lot of filmmakers. I chose to not have a release not to have Sun Mu sign a release. Everyone else in the film signed a release, but, because of the situation, because of the relationship, because of the danger that he was in and the trust that he was giving me to tell his story, I chose, it felt inappropriate to have him sign a release form. Because first of all, at the end of the day, if there's anything that he doesn't want in the film because of his safety, I'm not going to put it in there. It's just my moral obligation. And it felt like, because I never made him sign a release, that really sealed the relationship and the trust. But there are other people in the film, his mentor and the curator, the guy that Liang Kagong, who is a Chinese artist who curated Sun Mu's exhibit in China, who they actually did sign releases. When the original version of the film was cut, one of them said, can you please take, actually both of them had me take certain things out, asked me to. And of course I did, because they were incriminating. With Sun Mu, he was certainly in danger, but he's always in danger. And he's purposefully putting himself in danger. But there were other people that stuck their necks out for him, that one of them spent 9 months in self-imposed exile in South Korea. The other one was monitored heavily by the Chinese government after the exhibit. The people that surrounded Sun Mu were very much put in danger by the exhibit itself, not by my film. And I didn't want to further worsen that. But that being said, they also both know that by nature of being in this film, they could be in further danger. And I think about that all the time, and they still consented. They've asked me for certain specific things that to take out, and I've done that. But they've chosen to stay in the film. And I mean, I think that's brave of them, because I don't think the film would work, or we could tell Sun Mu's story without telling their story as well.
Yeah. What role do you have your subjects play in reviewing the cuts or the edits that you're putting together before it's actually released?
Oh, that's, that one's a tough one. I mean, there's a fine line. It has to be a trusting relationship. It has to be a little bit of a give and take. I'm not going to send, when we were working on the film, I would send cuts to Sun Mu. And I should mention, like, Sun Mu, going back to what I was saying earlier about help, people telling their own story, Sun Mu was very involved in the making of the film. He, there's a lot of animation in the film, and he helped with all of the animation sequences. I gave him a camera at the beginning of the project, so he did a lot of filming himself. So he was not just the subject, but he helped make the film. And so I would share cuts with him, and I think because he's an artist, he really respected me as the filmmaker and respected that role, and he would give little bits of input, or he would just say, oh, I like the other cut better, or he's very blunt. So he would just say, you know, I don't like that part, or this part was boring, you know, but he would never tell me what to do or not to do. So that was, you know, I think we had the appropriate back and forth in that regard. But that can get sticky, because you don't, as the filmmaker, you still have to be the artist. You have to be the one in control of your product, or the final product. You have to be able to stand behind it. So I think it has to be, again, it goes back to, if you have that relationship, then it can be a conversation, if that makes sense. There's not a set of rules for that one, because it is a conversation.
Yeah. And do you think, in thinking in the nonprofit sector, is that the conversation, is that the responsibility of the nonprofit to be having with their subjects?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to coming alongside a nonprofit, the nonprofit they are the people that are hopefully maintaining the day-to-day relationships with these people. So yeah, I think that is that, you know, they have to be, they are the ones that are ultimately responsible for permission, you know, as a whole, you know. And I think, you know, for example, if it's photos of people that have benefited from wells, you know, that from wells that have been dug in an area where there wasn't clean water, and it's photos of those people, you know, I think there has to be a generosity. If they're giving, you know, there has to be an exchange. I don't think you can rightfully take that person's image and use it and not have there be an exchange. So I think there should always be some form of payment, some form of agreement, that happens, some kind of, and therefore consent, and therefore, you know, usage rights. So, and you know, like anybody, you can't necessarily, like, once the brochure is printed and you've gone through all of the ethical steps to use that person's image, then yeah, like, they can't go in and say, you know, and sue you or tell you not to use them. But if you've gone through all the appropriate steps, and I think that is the nonprofit's job. I think it ends up being the job of us documentarians to help educate some of these nonprofits. You know, I've seen nonprofits, this is far more seldom now, but I've seen nonprofits literally be like, yeah, just go in, just go photograph them. We don't need to get any releases. We don't need to get permission. We don't need to know their names. They're benefiting from the work we're doing. So they, you know, I don't care and they don't care. Go photograph them. And then it ends up on a website and a brochure, and there have been lawsuits that have happened because of that. That is the nonprofit's responsibility, but as documentarians, I think sometimes we end up having to educate them.
In the context of ethical storytelling, what would you go back and say to yourself when you were just starting out, when you had just graduated?
Oh, man. That's the thing, is I feel when I, at the very beginning, when I said there has to be some generosity, like, I, some of these lessons don't settle in until you have experience. So I picture myself going and talking to myself, and I don't think I would have listened to myself. But, you know, I think I would say, the first thing that I would tell myself as a 22-year-old is it's all about relationships first. It's not about getting the cool image. Because when I first was a hotshot photographer right out of college, first time I went to Africa, all I wanted was, like, cool photos from my trip to Africa. And that's just selfish. So I would have told myself, you know, it's about people. It's about building relationships. And, you know, I wish I would have known when I first went to Africa that a few years later I really would form these, I would come back to Africa and I would form these lifelong friendships that I have to this day. Because that's so much more meaningful. And frankly, the photos are way better when you actually know the people and when you spend time in their home and you wait for the decisive moment of connection. That's when you get the really good photos.
I love that. Thank you, Adam. Everything you said has been so informative, and I think we're going to make you part of our team now.